Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's December 30th, 2006, the last Saturday of the year. I'm Harley Schlanger and I'll be your host today. In 5 days, a new Congress will be sworn in the middle of a profound crisis. The nation is losing a war we never should have started, and the global financial system is headed for a final breakdown. On top of this, we have a president who shows no sign that he is even remotely in the real world. He's preparing to announce an increase in troops to Iraq, which has taken up the name of the Surge, which goes against the best advice of his own Iraq study group and leading military advisors. And he's doing this at a time when only 35% of military personnel who were polled approve of his handling of the war. And of course, we have the president of Vice, Dick Cheney, who has plans for war against Iran ready to go. Yet, this is a moment for optimism, not just because it's a new year. So what is it that gives us reason to celebrate the coming new year? Well, 2006 has been a year of dramatic advances by the LaRouche movement. Lyndon LaRouche and his LaRouche Youth Movement have emerged as an increasingly important factor in politics in the United States and worldwide. For today's program, we're going to do a kind of year in review, looking at the events of this past year from the standpoint of Lyndon LaRouche's actions, his writings, and the effects of those actions and writings. Joining me today on the program will be a frequent guest, Jeffrey Steinberg. We'll also be joined by a two-person panel of members of the LaRouche Youth Movement. That will be Aaron Halevi from Los Angeles and David Nance from Washington, D.C. So, Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Harley. How you doing?
Good. In preparing for our discussion today, I skimmed through and did a little more than skimming the year's issues of the EIR. And by the way, I would recommend to anybody that they get on the LaRouche Pub website and do this and pick up some of the articles you didn't read from LaRouche, because you get a breathtaking picture of the developments of the year. Also, when you look at the statements from Lynn that were on the LaRouche pack, and what I rediscovered was what I already knew, which was that this was an eventful year, and there's no way we can cover it in an hour. However, to get a handle on it, let's begin by dividing it in two ways. I want to look at things partially chronologically, beginning with the collapse of the Democrats in December 2005, and then pick it up with the effect of Lyndon LaRouche's webcasts and seminars during the year to rally Democrats and honest Republicans and people in the military and intelligence community, the way LaRouche used the webcast to clarify the issues, both strategic and economic. And then beginning June, the increasing effect of the deployment of the LaRouche Youth Movement, including warnings of Cheney's plans for war with Iran, a so-called October surprise, and then the special mission undertaken by the LIM after September to defeat the Goebbels-style operations on the campuses, which ended up producing the landslide for the Democrats on November 7th. Then furthermore, the second way we're going to look at it, besides chronologically, is at the intervention of Lyndon LaRouche intellectually and scientifically, which really made 2006 the year of the rediscovery of Johannes Kepler. So that's how I'd like to look at it, and I think that will give our listeners at least a handle on what happened this last year and what they have to do in the coming weeks. So in the interest of maximizing the dialogue among our guests, we will not take emails on the air. However, if you do have questions, we will answer them. So just send them to radio@larouchepub.com. So, Jeff, let's begin with the end of 2005, beginning of 2006. The issue, really, that was on the table was, are there limits to a tyrant's power? I'm sure you remember that Cheney, in late December 2005, said that the president needs to have his constitutional powers unimpaired in terms of national security, that there should be no constitutional limits on the power of the presidency. And this came up around the attempt to ram through the Alito nomination. So take us back to that. What occurred at the end of 2005 with the Democratic Party that carried into the first part of 2006?
Well, there was a leadership breakdown, which was most clearly indicated by two developments, in a sense, one development and one lack of development. The development was the fact that the Democratic Party had the votes in the Senate to defeat the confirmation of Samuel Alito to the Supreme Court. And the very first webcast that Lyndon LaRouche gave in January of 2006 highlighted the danger inherent in a confirmation of Alito and identified the whole Federalist Society, Carl Schmitt current of fascist law that Alito promoted and which fit in perfectly with Cheney's idea of, I guess you could call it, the divine rights of vice presidents, for want of a better term.
Well, Jeff, from that January 11th, 2006 webcast, Lynn opened it by saying to the Senate, you have senators who should have more guts who are waffling in dealing with this fact. There is no honest debate about bringing Adolf Hitler and his tradition into the government of the United States.
Right, and in fact, the Senate caved. The Democrats had 45 votes in the Senate, more than enough to block a vote from occurring on the basis of a filibuster. They didn't do it, and it portended very poorly for what followed for much of 2006, because the other big issue, the one I referred to where the inaction was stunning, was the complete elimination of the automobile manufacturing sector of the U.S. economy, which occurred at a stunning rate of speed throughout the course of 2006 and is still going on into the closing moments of the year. And here, over the course of 2006, really beginning, in fact, in the early part of 2005, Lyndon LaRouche had picked up on the danger of the systematic takedown of the machine tool-centric automobile manufacturing sector and warned that it was a threat to national security for the Senate to remain inactive as this process occurred. Now, over the course of the year, one of the main things that we smoked out was the role of Felix Rohatyn through his private investment fund in literally overseeing the dismantling of Delphi, the parts section, formerly the parts section of General Motors. And so the role of Felix Rohatyn as the Democratic Party clone and partner of George Shultz came out over the course of the year. And our fight against Rohatyn cumulatively over the course of the year, while it has not yet turned around the shutdown of the auto sector, did have an appreciable effect within the Democratic Party to where, after about a 6 to 8 month continuing slide into complete impotence, we had somewhat of a turnaround when we got into the heart of the campaign season, beginning, as you said, around September of this year, when some elements of the Democratic Party clearly saw that the collapse of the economy, the complete fiasco in Iraq, the police state efforts by Cheney and others at the White House had energized the American people to repudiate the Bush-Cheney team, to repudiate the Republican Party. And some Democrats began to get enthusiastic again about the prospect of taking back power in the Congress.
Well, this came up in the first EIR, first issue of Executive Intelligence Review in 2006, targeted the role of the Federalist Society as a leading wing of the neocons, and along with that, Felix Rohatyn as their plant inside the Democratic Party. And this is what Lynn took up in that January 11th webcast. Now, as we move through that month, the other thing that LaRouche did was issue a paper which on reading it, I was just struck by how fresh it is, given what he's just done this last couple of days to put together a new paper to prepare the Congress for this new year. On January 27th, he published a paper called How to Capitalize a Recovery. And in that, he talked about how you do forecasting based on looking at Keplerian orbits. Now, I'd like to bring Aaron and David in on this because both of them were very active all year, David in Washington, D.C., and Aaron on the West Coast, but active not just in the street organizing day-to-day in the Congress and the Democratic Party, but also doing work on Kepler. And I'd like to hear from both of you on your perspective from this on the cusp of the new year, what the work on Kepler has meant in terms of understanding on the deeper level this economic crisis. So, Aaron, you want to say a couple things?
Well, yeah, I was thinking about it more from the standpoint of the end of the year, because there was a significant change in our activity as a youth movement beginning last year, or I guess this year, in January 1st, like the first day of the new year. We had a marathon investigation into Kepler's Mysterium Cosmographicum, which was the first book that he wrote, and on the question of the solar system and his investigations of it. And we took about a few months to work on that, but we were done probably around April or June. And then after that, we had started the new astronomy, which we are still working on. And I think that had a major effect on the deployment, not so much that just because we were thinking about these ideas that, like, the universe was changing in some mystical way, but that like, studying and immersing yourself in the method of Kepler is immersing yourself in the method of LaRouche, and that in his outlook on how to deploy our forces really did change in the minds of the people in the movement. We're capable of deploying more effectively into history with these developed conceptions of physical science. And that's one thing that I was thinking. And then also along with that is the music, is that we take the discoveries that we've been working on with the music, specifically like what's been happening in Boston and on the East Coast with Segerson and Priano, but just that bringing out this music to the population, it really does show that, like, we're not necessarily, you know, just doing it for fun, but it's the creative work that we do in the practice of the music work that then applies itself to our organizing. And that really did help change the situation with the election.
Mm-hmm. And David, do you have any comments on what you've seen from the effect of this work, both with the Kepler and the music in Washington, D.C.?
I would definitely agree with what Aaron said. It's a new project still to some extent, I guess, to the extent that we haven't obviously fully mastered the implications of it. But in terms of the effect it's had, obviously, just in looking at the work we've been doing on Lin's economics, some of us for many years and trying to understand specifically what he's trying to get at with the question of forecasting and looking at economic developments in terms of, you know, 25-year, 50-year cycles and so forth, and getting a real understanding of what that means. The work on Kepler has been a great help. And also on the deployments, we've been, bringing the Kepler into the deployments increasingly over the past couple of months. We're still working on honing in on how exactly to do that in the most efficient way possible, but you're increasingly getting more and more discussions about economics, astronomy, and so forth becoming more and more dominant in the day-to-day field organizing. And here there's also been an added emphasis on the G-Chorus principle, the guerrilla chorus principle, which has been applied in Boston and other places in terms of getting a mass effect. And really trying to get these ideas we're working on in the office out into the population, out into the major shopping centers and so forth during Christmas. So it's definitely had a positive influence, and it's upgraded the work quite a bit in terms of getting at this question of the mass effect and so forth.
Well, this is the LaRouche Show, and you're listening to A Year in Review. We're hearing from members of the LaRouche Youth Movement who played an increasingly prominent role in shaping the political fights. Jeff, to go back to as we come through January and the Senate had dropped the ball on the Alito fight, there was a moment, there was almost a moment of levity on February 11th when Dick Cheney shot probably the one trial lawyer in the country that supported the administration. And it was a moment where the TV comedians had a great deal of fun with it, but it actually exemplified another aspect of the 2006, which is I counted at least five occasions where Lyndon LaRouche said, we've got to get Cheney out of there. What's the significance of that February 11th event from the standpoint of where we are now with Dick Cheney?
Well, I think this is also a good example of Keplerian orbits as they offer a way to understand political processes. Lyndon LaRouche made his first call for Cheney's removal from office in August of 2002 because it was clear that Cheney was the driving factor inside the Bush administration, pushing for the invasion of Iraq on completely false grounds. And so we've gone through the invasion. And at the very outset, when LaRouche first said Cheney has to go, even among people who agreed in principle, the general attitude was he's too powerful, he's too deeply ensconced, it'll never happen, go for some lower order target. And we said no. You have to be persistent because nothing short of Cheney's removal will change the situation. Now, by the time we got around to February of 2004, our campaign against Cheney had developed a certain traction. His own activities, the folly of the Iraq War, the lies and everything that went into that had begun to have the kind of cumulative effect that when the incident occurred in Texas, it was really a metaphor for a whole series of things that had built up over the previous several years. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in typical ham-fisted fashion, Cheney did everything to maximize the political impact of the incident. The lies that were told, the attempts to cover it up, the completely cavalier attitude that Cheney took over the fact that he nearly murdered somebody. All of these things, probably it'll be 50 or 100 years before the Secret Service files on that incident itself come out in the public light. You know, whether he was drinking when the incident occurred, who knows what. But it really served to catalyze what had been built up by that point as a recognition that, you know, whether people voiced it in these terms or not, LaRouche was right. Cheney is the center of the disease, at least inside the immediate environments of the White House. And he does have to go. Mm-hmm. Now we're at a point where we're talking about another war. And this is another one of the issues that came up over the course of 2006, the clear and emerging intent of Cheney and the neoconservative faction to attack Iran before they leave office. And there were several points during the course of 2006 where there was a very real danger that an attack would occur, one during the August congressional recess when there was nobody in town to stop them. And then secondly, we were very concerned about the period in the immediate run-up to the November elections where it was obvious to Mr. LaRouche that the Democrats were going to score a large victory despite themselves, and where we were concerned that Cheney might use some pretext, some Gulf of Tonkin-type incident, to stage an attack before the November elections.
A so-called October surprise.
Exactly. We put out millions of leaflets and pamphlets and articles on the website that were picked up by dozens of websites around the world, others within the military, radiated the same warning. Colonel Sam Gardner, a retired Air Force colonel, prepared a briefing book on the danger of an attack on Iraq. You had the revolt of the generals, first in the spring and then again a major outpouring in that October surprise danger zone. And this is not one of those cases where we were crying wolf and warned about something that really wasn't a danger. This was one of those cases where an intention to take action was defeated by a preemptive expose.
And that's now, actually been – that's part of the character of the whole year, that Lyndon LaRouche was consistently ahead of the game. I just want to go through a couple of events going back to our chronological review and then get comments from the panel on these. On February 18th, LaRouche released a prolegomena for a party platform, Franklin Roosevelt's Legacy, which he said was to prepare the Democratic Party for the 2006 midterm elections. The Democrats at that time, he said, were in retreat, and he said, we have to correct the Democrats' intention to wait until after the election to formulate a program. And so there was an immediate relationship between the release of the platform and its political intention, which was to cause the Democrats to change the policy back toward an FDR party. Now, there was a webcast then on February 23rd where Lynn put forward the idea of the question of leadership and the failure of the boomer generation. And then on March 2nd, a special EIR seminar in Berlin where he addressed the deeper issues of the economy and put forward the Eurasian perspective. And, of course, that occurred precisely as there was a new emergence of an Iran crisis. So I know, Jeff, you have vivid memories of these events. I'm wondering, Aaron and David, you can jump in any time if you have something to add in terms of the year in review. But, Jeff, were you at that Berlin conference?
No, my wife, Michelle, was at that conference. I was at the subsequent conference in June.
And the idea of these conferences was to not merely put forward the idea of a Eurasian perspective, but actually to correct the misconceptions in Europe about what was going on in the United States.
Very much so. And to the point that by the spring-summer of 2006, there had been a series of about five seminars in Berlin, which brought together leading political figures from throughout Eurasia. And at each of those seminars, we had an American delegation there along with Mr. LaRouche. And we were really hammering away at those issues. By the fall of this year, it was clear that that point had been driven home. And that the possibilities of revolutionary change inside the United States were becoming more evident. And at that point, Mr. LaRouche shifted gears. And first in September and then again in October, or maybe it was October and then again in November. No, September, October. Mr. LaRouche had a series of international webcasts from Berlin, but with a live audience in Washington and very much oriented towards bringing the international support for LaRouche's perspective of revolutionary change in the United States into the U.S. equation. And I can tell you that the participation of leading political figures, leading economists from Russia and China and India in particular, in these two dialogues, strategic global dialogues with Mr. LaRouche, beamed into Washington, had a significant effect in opening up the political process in the United States in the countdown 2 months before the November election, bringing to bear the international responsibilities of the U.S. government, by bringing these outside voices into the dialogue itself.
And Jeff, I think one of the important things is that, as Mr. LaRouche has often done, he provided the perspective and the historic understanding, which otherwise is missing in people who are well-meaning and is being distorted by those who are trying to conduct operations. For example, in March and then again in September, one of the themes of his webcast from Berlin is that the Iran crisis, the Mideast crisis, it's a British game. The targets are Russia and China, but ultimately the target of the policies that are being imposed on Bush and Cheney, the target is the United States. And I think this is an important point from the course of the whole year to get across to Americans that, you know, the bell is tolling for us if we don't change.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think that, you know, in a certain sense, that point was grasped to one degree or other by a majority of people who turned out to vote on November 7th, because there was a very interesting pattern that people saw the emerging self-destruction of the United States. And I think many people had to think through the folly of their own behavior in the previous two elections in allowing a Bush-Cheney ticket to be elected in 2000 and then reelected in 2004. Now, both of those elections are subject to a lot of skepticism as to whether Bush and Cheney actually won either of them. But nevertheless, the fact that it was close enough that these guys could even steal it tells you that there was something drastically, tragically wrong with the thinking of the American people. And, you know, LaRouche has emphasized that a great power like the United States, really since the time of the end of the Civil War, when we emerged as the greatest industrial power on the planet, it was clear to the British that we couldn't be destroyed from the outside, and we had to be destroyed from within. And the Bush-Cheney administration probably represents the most successful effort by the enemies of the United States, particularly those centered within the financial oligarchy in London, to destroy the United States from within. And voters finally got that. And not only was it a vote of no confidence in Bush and Cheney, really a referendum for impeachment, but some of the better Republicans, like Lincoln Chafee in Rhode Island and Mike DeWine in Ohio, were defeated because they failed to jump ship in time. Mm-hmm. They were defeated not because of their own individual records, but because they were part of the Republican majority that brought this disaster on.
Now we're going to go to break in a few seconds. I just want to mention a couple other events in this time period. One was an extremely important expose that you did, Jeff, on the collaboration between Rowett and Schultz and Cheney in military privatization, the development of the so-called PMCs, private military corporations. And this will be a subject of investigation with the new Congress. Also, the General's Revolt, which you referenced before, which started in mid-April. But we'll come back in just a moment with Jeffrey Steinberg and Aaron Halevy and David Nance to take up the year in review, 2006. This is the LaRouche Show, which is live on the web every Saturday from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. It's also available. Each of the shows has been archived. So you can go back during the course of the year and look at the previous discussions we've had on the program with leading figures in the LaRouche movement, as well as increasingly this year we began to bring people in who are either collaborators or co-thinkers to discuss the relevant, timely issues of the day. You go to the LaRouchePub.com and look at the, on the left-hand side, it says The LaRouche Show, and you can get from that an archive of the programs of this year and previous years. Now, also, we have some work to do before the Congress gets into session on January 4th. We want to get out the pamphlets that we have from the last webcasts of Lyndon LaRouche, and you can contact us to get them at 800-929-7566. That's 800-929-7566. And as you've heard so far in the show, these webcasts were a critical part of transforming the country during the year 2006. So again, 800-929-7566. Now, clearly, we're entering a period of time where in the March, April, and May, the question of the Democratic Party policy came to the forefront. I want to ask Aaron to just Aaron co-authored an article with me on the California State Democratic Convention in late April, where the issue was, would the Democrats go down with Roatan? Aaron, I don't think the California Democrats quite got during 2006 the message we were trying to get to them, did they?
Yeah, they had something else in their ears, I guess.
Well, how did this Roatan question come up at the convention? What were we doing there?
Well, I remember we had chartered the Franklin Roosevelt Legacy Club a couple of weeks before the convention, and so we had secured ourselves a place inside the convention, which was really, really good when it started. But we had brought out a banner talking about Roatan and Schultz, and it was really good. You can see a picture of it on the website. But I remember bringing it up, and the problem was, I remember that Phil Angelides was praising Roatan for his understanding in infrastructure, and that he was going to go to him where he elected governor. And they just didn't get the message. I mean, there's pictures of us singing right in front of the convention, very loudly, bel canto style, the Bach Jesu meine Freude, and something just couldn't still get through to these guys. So, I mean, it was a really good intervention, and we had repeated then after that across the country interventions into all these different conventions throughout the Democratic Party around the country. And I think that's what Jeff brought up. Like, eventually these guys did loosen themselves from the grasp of Roatan, at least some of these Democrats.
Absolutely. But the key thing on California that's important in terms of the national picture is that we had defeated Schwarzenegger in November 2005 with a mobilization, and they retooled him in January 2006 as the infrastructure guy, and it was a Schultz-Roatan inside job against the Democratic Party. And in California, as a result, Arnie won re-election in spite of the overwhelming Democratic vote nationally, and it's a stain on the honor of the California Democratic Party. Now, To move ahead, Jeff, this question of outsourcing the role of Roatan, it came up again at the Texas convention where the LIM made history with Keisha Rogers, a leader of the LaRouche Youth Movement in Texas, ran for state party chairman. And June 22nd, LaRouche once again went after the Senate Democrats with an article called Time is Running Out for the USA. And then on June 27th, the next Berlin seminar, the topic was Defeat Synarchist Globalization with a New Bretton Woods. Now, I know you were at that one. How was that received? That was one where the idea of synarchism was put forward as the enemy of the United States.
Yeah, well, we did a number of things there that also radiated dramatically back into the U.S. We took the case of Felix Rahatan, and we actually went back to the wartime archives of the U.S. military, some material that is now publicly available at the National Archives in Washington, D.C. And there was an understanding among senior U.S. military intelligence people that above the fascism and Nazism in Europe, there was an overarching entity which was called the Synarchist International, which subsumed the hardcore jackboot fascists and Nazis, but also was directed by leading financial circles that favored fascism overwhelmingly over anything that FDR represented with his revival of the American system. And so we had documents, I had them in my hands in Berlin, showing that U.S. government officials had name, rank, serial number of leading bankers who sponsored European fascism, and that among the people on the list in the documents I had in my possession was André Maillard, who was from Lazard Bank and who was Felix Rowetten's mentor and sponsor for his entire career as a synarchist banker. And at that point, we also already had the documentation of Rowetten's personal role in the dismantling and asset stripping of the auto manufacturing machine tool sector in the United States. That at that point, around the case of Delphi, where Rowetten was a consultant in the takedown and dismantling and sell-off of Delphi. This had a stunning effect on the audience in Berlin, and an even more dramatic effect on people inside the Congress, leading Democrats, both members of Congress and senior staffers, who were forced to confront the evidence in black and white of both the fascist roots, the synarchist fascist roots of Rowetten, and Rowetten's direct hand in the destruction of the industrial base of the United States.
It was right after that Berlin seminar then that this was brought back into Washington, D.C. with the July 20th webcast, which occurred at precisely the moment that the Truman Project was being launched by Rowetten and his DLC networks in the Democratic Party. Now, David, you were involved in that week of action leading into the webcast on the 20th. I'm told we began to get a little more serious reaction from the Congress at that time. Do you remember much about that?
A bit, actually. My memory is not completely fresh. But I do recall on the Rowetten affair, what Jeff was just going through a second ago, it was very interesting as a fight because at the beginning stages of introducing the Rowetten thing, there was almost a response from the Democrats, by and large, that they essentially had no idea who this guy was. There was generally, you would walk into these offices, you'd go through the briefing and so forth, and people would pretend as if they'd never heard of him. And as Lynn kept hitting on this flank, and as we kept putting out more and more material, you increasingly began to see people actually coming out and finally admitting that they actually knew who the guy was, but then, you know, offering various excuses for why they either thought his infrastructure programs had some legitimacy for, in terms of, you know, determining policy, or in different cases, you would find people just becoming very uneasy about the idea of, you know, being associated in some way with Rowetten or being offended at the way Lynn was going at Felix Rowetten. That sticks out very distinctly in my mind, just as a, you know, sort of as a phase shift in terms of the organizing we did on Capitol Hill.
Well, that's interesting because then as Lynn took up this initiative at the beginning of August, there were two, I would say, again, parallel developments from what Mr. LaRouche was involved in. One, in the August 4th Executive Intelligence Review was a publication of an article on Kepler, Animating Nonlinear Economic Processes, which took on the looting approach of Rowetten and the idea that you cannot develop the economy unless you change the underlying thinking. And virtually at the same time, LaRouche issued his warning of an October surprise. So here we were, moving into the traditional election period. At that point, it was anybody's guess what would happen. Most of Washington, official Washington, figured that Karl Rove had the election in the bag. Would you say that's the general thinking in August, Jeff?
It certainly was, especially after the horrible, defensive, impotent performance by the majority of Democrats in the period leading into that. There was another factor that we were aware of and which basically colored a lot of our own activity going into the hot phase of the campaign, which is that sometime in the early spring of 1996, the heads of the Senate and House Democratic campaign committees, Chuck Schumer in the Senate, Rahm Emanuel in the House, found out that the Democratic National Committee under Howard Dean had basically squandered away $30 million in funds that had been accumulating to be used for candidate support in the 2006 midterm election.
Right. Everyone was shocked when Dean came out and said, we've got no more money.
Right. And what later evolved is that Dean had basically dispersed these funds to build up his own petty bureaucracy within each of the 50 state Democratic parties. The money was dispersed to hire Howard Dean loyalists to work for the state party chairs and on developing computer databases, all the sorts of things that are far less useful.
Well, that had been losing Democrats' elections.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so Schumer and Emanuel went nuts for very good reason. And here they saw an election where clearly everything was directed towards a potential Democratic landslide victory, even despite the poor performance of the Democrats within the Congress. And suddenly $30 million vital to that effort are gone. That's not chump change in a congressional election season, $30 million. We knew that. We were told about this at the time. And so we understood that you had to basically turn adversity to an advantage by demonstrating that political campaigns are won not by money, but by outreach to the lower 80%.
Well,
and in September, Lyndon LaRouche opened up a strategic flank. He said, look, we've got a youth movement that is an extremely effective political organizing machine. It's limited in size, and therefore we can't make the mistake of diluting their efforts.
And, Jeff, before we go into the campaign strategy and the aftermath, let me just remind people this is the LaRouche Show. If you want to get copies of the pamphlets, give us a call at 800-929-7566. And I want to urge you to put down on your calendar January 11th. Which will be the next webcast given by Lyndon LaRouche. You can see from this review we're doing today how absolutely significant each of these webcasts have been. Now, as we're getting into the final period of the year, let me just throw a couple of other things in that we were involved in and doing, and then we'll take up the stunning events that were not so stunning to those of us on the ground, but certainly stunned the pundits and the pollsters. As we were moving into the August period, that's when there was an invasion of Lebanon by Israel. And once again, the alternatives were clear. The Cheney-Bush administration backing the war versus Lyndon LaRouche's intervention for the idea of a peace of Westphalia, a second Madrid conference to take up the Oasis plan. Now, as we got into September, the lead story in the EIR September 1st, and I just want your comments on this, Jeff, because I know you know this from the inside. The lead story was, is President Bush nuts? And it was a reference back to Justin Frank's book and also the way the press was finally beginning to treat Bush, including Stephen Colbert, as well as the defeat of Joe Lieberman, who was the Bush buddy. So, Jeff, you have any quick comments on the mental health of our president?
Well, one of the things that was clear is that over the course of 2006, the president's state of mind, as bad as it was at the outset of his presidency, really took a sudden and sustained turn for the worse. And the Colbert incident, I don't remember the date that it occurred, but it was at the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner. I think it was in the late spring of the year.
Yeah, it was April, at the end of April.
Right. Had a stunning effect because it just, again, was one of those moments that captured a whole process in a kind of snapshot. Mm-hmm. The image of Colbert slicing and dicing the failures of the Bush presidency with tremendous humor and irony, while Bush sat there about 3 or 4 feet away from him on the dais, frozen in a furious stare. That just sort of catalyzed. It reminds me of the famous story of the emperor's new clothes, where the kid basically says the emperor's naked, and suddenly everybody was able to speak the truth, which they had been terrified to say. So Bush's deterioration, plus the deterioration of the situation in Iraq, plus the deterioration of the economy, all of these factors cumulatively built up, and the American population were ready for revolutionary political change, a return back to our fundamental character as a nation as we moved into this election period. And Lynn zeroed in on the youth vote.
And to hit this really properly, we have to understand one other element that came in September, which was the end of September, the release by EIR and LPAC, LaRouche PAC, of the John Train Lynn Cheney dossier, which went out as a mass pamphlet, Goebbels is Goebbels on your campus, because this is what was needed to get the youth vote going, was to lift the lid off the campuses. And I'd like to hear also just now briefly from Aaron and David on the effect that this pamphlet had in the organizing we did in terms of catalyzing a youth vote to spearhead the victory in November.
Well, I would say that it gave us a real way to affect the entire process, although, as you pointed out, that we are a limited force, that we were able to change the entire election based on a specific intervention towards this releasing the youth from these shackles of this beast woman, Lynn Cheney. And the expose was solid, just on a realization of our part, just that, you know, we've been dealing with these students for a long time and not necessarily recognizing where this campus apathy was coming from. But now that we figured it out through these investigations, it really does give people a sense like you can lift the chains off of them and say, well, look, you know, this is why you're not thinking about politics. And a lot of people changed as a result of that, and all over the country, really. And I thought it was very effective. We were down in San Diego and around the campuses here, and it really did cause a good effect. We had a lot of articles that were written about us or against us, but there was a good dialogue regardless on the topics we had brought up in these pamphlets in our mass saturation of them as well.
And David, you noticed a similar effect on the East Coast.
Yeah, definitely. We got a lot of a whole lot of freakouts around this this particular flank here on the campuses, and it's similar to what Aaron was raising, which is that for a number of months their campuses just sort of lay dormant as all these things were occurring. We had the Israel operation against Lebanon. You had all these things happening, which were relatively big news items and seemed to be the kinds of things that would elicit a real spirit of revolution on college campuses, but you were seeing absolutely nothing, at least nothing significant. And as soon as we hit with this pamphlet and started going after the David Horowitz, Lynn Cheney, Lieberman, and so forth conspiracy to suppress, free speech and, you know, revolutionary thinking on college campuses, all of a sudden you began to see more and more students, people in student government, professors, even parents, baby boomer parents, coming out of the woodworks and essentially saying, we support you guys. Even some would argue that they disagreed with Lynn, but they would come out and contribute to our campaign in order to reverse the spirit of, you know, this Orwellian kind of impulse that had taken over the college campuses. So it was definitely a very, very important campaign, and it did a heck of a lot to sort of revive a spirit of activism on the campuses, as well as revive a sense that the youth should play a critical role in the in what would then be the November 7th election.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Jeff, you and I were in relatively constant discussion about the deployment, how we would take our small but effective forces onto the campuses as a catalyst, which Lynn then later wrote up in an article, Johannes Kepler and the Democratic Challenge, The New Politics. What was the effect on official Washington, the shock, when they found that young people did go out and vote and that was a critical margin?
Well, official Washington has been saturated by the LaRouche youth movement over the course of the last 2-3 year period. And so, key people in Congress, I'd say virtually everybody who operates in the federal district area of Washington, D.C., around the White House, the State Department, of course, Capitol Hill, the Pentagon, they know the LaRouche youth movement. They know us from mass literature distributions on Capitol Hill. They know us from, continuous lobbying activity. They know us from the guerrilla chorus work. So, therefore, they were very attentive already in advance to the issue of this youth factor in the 2006 elections. And so I think the level of awareness that we were the factor that catalyzed something far different than they expected on November 7th was more widely recognized in Washington than perhaps in other parts of the country. And then, of course, you had the follow-on election on December 12th in San Antonio.
And I was going to say that one brought total awareness in Texas of the effect of the catalytic force of young people.
And it was seen in Washington as a proof of principle of what we were saying about what had happened on November 7th. I mean, the statistics in this case did not lie. In 4 years ago, there were about 8 million young voters, 18 to 35. In 2006, there were well over 10 million voters, with the overwhelming increase of those 2 million plus added voters going to the Democrats. So the youth factor was decisive in what was a mini landslide by the Democrats, and which people like James Carville know could have been an overwhelming landslide were it not for the inside sabotage by Howard Dean, the DLC, Rohatyn, and other self-sabotaging factors within the Democratic Party. So there's a day of reckoning coming on that issue, which will be crucial in determining what happens in the course of the next 2 years and in determining who's the next president of the United States.
Well, amazingly, we've made it to the election, and we still have a little bit of time to talk about what we do now. Let me just mention that Lyndon LaRouche gave a webcast on October 31st in which he expressed his optimism about November 7th before the election. He knew this margin would be there. And then on November 16th, a second webcast titled Organizing the Recovery from the Great Crash of 2007. And these two webcasts are in a pamphlet that's available to our listeners. Call us if you want it at 800-929-7566. Now, despite the overwhelming vote on November 7th, the rejection of Cheney, the rejection of the Stay the Course policy on Iraq, the administration is still not just saying that they're going to stay the course, but they're going to escalate. On top of that, on December 6th, the Iraq Study Group, the Baker-Hamilton Commission, came out with a report saying the situation in Iraq is grave and deteriorating and called for a change. And this recommendation has been rejected by President Bush. So, Jeff, here we are, the end of an eventful year, a year in which the American people have spoken out against these policies, and yet we see this drive coming in as we head into the new year. How do you expect the Congress to react, And what are we going to be doing to shape that?
You're going to have a dramatically different political situation in Washington starting this coming week when the 110th Congress is sworn in. And many of the things that Cheney and Bush got away with for the last 6 years are over and finished and done with. And to the extent that there are people around President Bush, members of his immediate family, close advisors, who have any interest or concern about salvaging the legacy of the Bush dynasty after the disastrous George W. Bush presidency, are going to find increasingly, very quickly, that continuing to keep Dick Cheney in as vice president is incompatible with saving the Bush legacy. And the Democratic majority in the House and the Senate is going to find its ranks swelled by a number of Republicans who, for a wide range of reasons, some of them patriotic, some of them opportunistic, are going to break decisively with the White House. And you're going to be very quickly moving into dramatic changes. You're going to have hearings beginning right away on both the Baker-Hamilton report, on the crimes of Cheney. You've got the Lewis Libby trial coming up beginning in January. You've got major turbulence on the financial markets. The housing bubble in the United States is blowing. The dollar is crashing. And we're entering into a period of strategic change and turbulence, which is going to look very different 2-3 weeks from now than it even looks at this moment. And LaRouche's simple marching orders to the Congress, to both the Democratic majority and the sane Republicans, is get Cheney out of there. If you don't do that, and if you get the impulse towards impeachment focusing on Bush and not Cheney, then the danger is that you're going to have a Cheney presidency and then the planet blows up. So increasingly, events are going to drive things towards the removal of Cheney from office in the early part of 2007. And that issue is going to determine where the administration, where the country, and where the world goes in this most important upcoming new year.
And the webcast then January 11th is going to be critical for providing the shape and direction for the Democratic Party. David, I assume we have a week of action in Washington, D.C. around the webcast. Is that right?
That's correct.
And we'll be going, besides with the marching orders on getting Cheney first, the Emergency Reconstruction Act is back on the agenda, especially as the Democrats are going to have to stand for something other than "we're not Bush."
Exactly.
So, Jeff, we have a little less than 2 minutes. This has been a most dramatic year, and I presume that you're coming into the new year with a real sense from the inside that people are recognizing that change is necessary.
Yeah, this is LaRouche's year. 2007 is going to be the year where the Democratic Party is going to have to present big ideas to the American people. One of the most crucial overarching factors that led to the Republican defeat on November 7th is that people had the feeling that the future is looking bleak under this Republican domination of the executive, legislative, and judicial branches, and that they saw the prospect of the future that their children and grandchildren are going to inherit looks worse than the future that they themselves inherited. That is so contrary to the American tradition that people said, we need something different. But now the Democrats are going to have to come up with some big ideas on how to reinstill optimism into the American people. And that's where Lyndon LaRouche has all the trump cards. And that's what January 11th is going to be all about. And I would say that anybody listening to this show today has to move heaven and earth to make sure that they are available to either attend in person or hear over the internet what LaRouche has to say on January 11th.
It'll be on LaRouche PAC website at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, January 11th. The LaRouche Youth Movement came of age this year and is moving for bigger and better things next year. Aaron and David, thank you. Jeffrey, thank you very much. And this has been the LaRouche Show.